This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Next slide, please. Dr. Scott Wechselblad from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Regional Newborn Services will start us out by talking about screening and testing considerations. Dr. Wechselblad?
Hi. Sorry, I was having trouble with the mute and the non-mute. So I'm going to try to describe the difference between screening and testing, two completely different words that were probably used interchangeably in the past, and we want to make sure that when we use those two words that we know exactly what we're talking to. Next slide. So screening is when we is recommended by ACOG that every woman is screened at the beginning of prenatal care with a questionnaire. A screen is something that is administered to decide if a test is needed. A test always gives you a definitive result, either a number or a positive or a negative. A screen weeds out a large population and determines who actually needs to be tested. So once again, ACOG recommends every woman have a screen performed, and then if there's a positive screen, then testing should be performed. And ACOG also recommends that any woman having a test performed be consented. Next slide. So screening for drugs of abuse, best practice by ACOG is to screen everyone with a short questionnaire at a first prenatal visit and on admission to labor and delivery. It is also recommended that a hospital has a standard policy, and this policy should be applied to all women that are admitted to the hospital, and that this screen then triggers specific tests that need to be determined after the screen is administered. Historically, there were specific triggers of no prenatal care, positive toxicology screen, or observed behaviors that will lead to a test that should be not a screen. And some advocates suggest universal testing to prevent bias. And I'm going to get to, we're going to talk about what we're doing in the Cincinnati region after Dr. Crowley describes what they're doing, their universal screening process that they're doing up in the Cleveland region. And as I mentioned earlier, that all women should be informed that a test is being performed. Next slide. So what type of toxicology tests are there? Urine, the most common one is the immunoassay. This test is a screen, basically. It doesn't differentiate, for example, if we talk about opioids. Immunoassay will tell you if there's an opioid, whereas if you then go on to a mass spectroscopy, that will actually then break down what opioid you are positive for. It can differentiate between hydromorphine and hydrocodone, methadone, buprenorphine. So there, even when you go into testing, there's different types of tests that we can perform. The advantage of a urine immunoassay is very fast and relatively inexpensive. One of the problems with urine testing is that it only detects recent exposure, 24 to 48 hours usually. And then the recommendation is, since the immunoassay is sort of a screen, meaning it captures a large net and it doesn't give you a specific answer, it just gives you a positive or negative, an immunoassay, a mass spec, the GC-MS is what we're talking about there, will actually give you a level and tell you, break it down even further. Besides just being positive for opioids, it will then break it down even further. Another disadvantage when we talk about any tests are false positives and false negatives, but this is a definite issue with the immunoassay testing that we do. Next slide. So some reasons that we have false positive and false negatives: sometimes the urine is too dilute. It's easy to deliberately adulterate the test, adding Visine or water to change the results. Another problem is the false positive. The immunoassays cross-reacts with the test. It has trouble differentiating very similar molecules. So an example is poppy seeds. Poppy seeds come from the poppy plant, the same as heroin also comes from the same poppy plant. So an immunoassay cannot differentiate the difference between a poppy seed and heroin. So that's where it will give you a positive test result for opioid. And then you'd have to go on to mass spectrometry to then decide what levels you actually have to differentiate if this is a true positive or false positive. Next slide. And these are just some other illustration of similar structures that can cross-react. You can see dextromethorphan, which is very common over-the-counter with ibuprofen, very similar, and so on and so forth. So anytime you have a positive, you have to make sure you have a confirmation process in your policy to know how you're going to follow up with a positive result. Next slide. So then how do we test the infant? There's multiple ways. Urine, same problem with urine is that this only detects short exposure. It's hard to collect urine on infants. They may only have one urine the first 24 hours. Meconium umbilical cord gives you exposure going back usually to around 20 weeks gestation. The nice thing about this, it gives you a long picture of what the baby's been exposed to between the 20th week and delivery. Problems with meconium is collection. Usually takes a day or so or 2 days to collect it, and the baby may not start having any meconium pass until 24 hours, so the sample may not be sent out to around 48 to 72 hours. Umbilical cord is easier to collect, but both at the current process, the only way to do meconium and umbilical cord is to do mass spec testing on that, and that's usually a send-out 24-hour turnaround. You can't get the rapid turnaround that you can with an immunoassay, which like you can on the urine. Next slide. And I think we just sort of talked about these. So we'll go to the next slide. And then Dr. Crowley is going to discuss how they do their universal screening process up in the Cleveland region.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm going to, like Dr. Wexelbeck said, talk about what we do up at McDonald's and Rainbow Babies about universal screening. So next slide. So as we've talked about before, ACOG and AAP recommend against universal toxicology testing. However, screening is an essential part of complete obstetric care. This should probably be done preconception as well as early in pregnancy, and it should be done in every woman. Next slide. So it should be asked to all patients presenting to in the obstetric clinic, and you want to tell the moms that you are asking everyone so they don't feel that they're singled out. It should be done in a non-judgmental fashion. The results, you know, you should assure the mom that you're going to keep these confidential, and you want to let her know that you need to know this information to be able to provide adequate care for both her and her developing fetus. And you want to ask about both illicit substances as well as prescribed substances. Next slide. So there are several questionnaire tools that have been reported in the literature to, you know, use to be able to ask women and other people about possible substance use. Here are three examples. And the references are down at the bottom of the screen for you to use if you need to. So one example is the five P's. And so these are all five questions that deal with P's, asking the woman about her parents' use, her friend's use, her partner's use, her past use of any substances, as well as what she actually was taking before pregnancy. The CRAFT tool is geared towards 16 to 26-year-olds, and it consists of six items and measuring the use of substances or any concerns for substance use among the questioner. And the SERPY is the Substance Use Risk Profile Pregnancy Scale, and that is only three questions. So you can see that, you know, three to six questions, they're very easy to ask, and if you have a positive result in any of these questions, then you can further ask more questions and consider testing. Next slide. So What we do is all women are screened early in their pregnancy as well as once they arrive to labor and delivery. Our general admission consent form does include consent for testing. However, we must disclose to a woman that a test is being sent and she can refuse. So situations where testing is indicated is if there is any positive screen on our screening questions, if the woman has had a positive toxicology screen in the past 2 years, if there's been a referral from an outside social service or our own social work has concern, and if under certain clinical indications such as poor prenatal care, no prenatal care, abruption, or if the woman appears to be intoxicated. Next slide. So when testing is indicated, we have to document the indication and disclose that to the mother. If she declines, we also will document that in the medical record, and the obstetricians are actually very good at discussing that and letting the pediatric team know so that we have the pediatricians have an idea of what's going on with the baby. And then we have a policy of when we actually will test the infant. So we test an infant if a mother declines testing and there's concern. If the mother has a positive toxicology screen or toxicology test, and if the infant exhibits any signs or symptoms of withdrawal. Next slide. So we worry, you know, if since we're only doing screens, we're not testing every mother, are we missing any babies? And, you know, looking back at our readmissions in the past 6 months, there have been no babies that have been readmitted due to neonatal abstinence. So it seems like we're doing okay with our universal screening approach. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Dr. Wexelblatt, and he's going to talk about what they're doing in Cincinnati about universal testing.
Thanks. Next slide. Yeah, the next slide, too. So we started as keep on going. One more slide. So here we go. So this is Mercy Anderson Hospital, and you can see this is the rate of the top line is drug-exposed infants per 1,000 births. Top line is Mercy Anderson. The line below that is our Cincinnati region. So Mercy Anderson was experienced a lot more exposed infants than children's, our Cincinnati region, sorry. And then the bottom two lines is the rate of infants that needed to be treated for NAS. And you can see that they were having almost a twofold increase in severity of infants with that needed treatment for neonatal abstinence syndrome. So they decided, next slide, to go ahead and do a period of universal testing. We had been doing universal screening. Every mom was being screened according to the ACOG recommendation. Next slide. And this was our screen that we were using. It was a little different than the screening, like Dr. Crowley talked about, the three P's of the craft. This was just the screen that was in place. And you can see that when we look at this screen, it came across to our legal department when we talked about moving towards universal testing, maybe being profiling, that to have a positive screen in this may have been just getting towards certain populations. It wasn't going through the whole, didn't seem to be, seemed to be a little bit of profiling. So we went ahead and did a six-month period where we tested every single mom when she came into the hospital, and we were happy with those results. So then we expanded it to 18 months. So I'm going to show you what we found on the next slide, which is a little busy. So I'll walk you through it. So you can see in the very top in the middle, you can see we had 3,000 admissions during this 18-month period. We only had 38 tests not done. This was either due to a precipitous delivery or just in the beginning of the process. We forgot we were testing every single mom, so a couple were just missed. And we only had one refusal, and I'm going to get to that refusal shortly. So then if you go down, you can see we sent 2,956 urines. And we look over to the far left, and you can see positive urine drug screen was 159 tests. So 5.4% of all the moms that showed up to the hospital during this period had a positive drug test for a substance. So then we broke it down. Do those positive for opioids? Are those positives for others? And the main reason we were concerned mostly about the positive for opiates, is the 96 women, is that, as you all know, neonatal abstinence syndrome, those signs and symptoms don't show up until 46 to 48 hours. So we were afraid that maybe we were discharging women who were obviously staying under 48 hours for their typical vaginal delivery, that these babies may be getting discharged and we weren't identifying them. So we looked at all of the 159 positive drug tests and said, would this mom have been tested if in our old system prior to universal testing, meaning did they have a screen? So the bottom row is the one that we're going to focus on. The box to the right, the total number of positive tests with a negative screen, meaning out of those 159 women, 36 or 23% of them had no risk factors on our previous screen. We would not have identified that mom or that infant. And then we said, let's look at all those opiate-exposed infants, those 96 opiate-exposed infants, and follow them throughout their hospital stay and look to see of those in the bottom left-hand corner, if you go up, the negative risk-based screen infants, there was 19 or 20% of the moms that were positive for opiates didn't have a screen. We wouldn't have identified them. So we followed those 19 infants. And what we found is the number of negative risk opioid-exposed infants needing an increase in their level of care was 7 of those 19, or 37% of those infants. So that's when we realized that these 7 infants may have been discharged home prior to having their signs and symptoms of NAS, that we decided to go ahead and expand our universal testing to the Cincinnati region. The way we did that in this at this hospital is that legal looked at the consent that a mom signs when she comes into the hospital, and it says laboratory tests will be done, so they felt like they were given consent in that process. One mom did refuse, but that was purely because she had poor insurance and she didn't want to get billed for the test. And what we decided, what we do in our region, if a mom refuses her universal test, we just then go ahead and do the infant. The reason we don't do universal testing on the infants, we do it on the moms. It's much easier to collect. As I mentioned earlier, the infants may not have a urine until late in their first 24 hours, and it's hard to collect. There's measures, you know, going through cotton balls or to collect the urine. So we found it was much easier to test the mom. So if you go to the next slide. We decided to go ahead and work with our Greater Cincinnati Health Council. So if you go to the next slide, you can see these are all the hospitals, the 13 hospitals that were part of the Greater Cincinnati Health Council. And we had to work together as a whole group because we knew if the hospital A and B were doing it, then moms would know that they'd go to hospitals C and D. So we realized that if we had to go about this in a uniform process, and so we went through the Greater Cincinnati Health Council and we initiated universal drug testing on the moms in September 1st of 2013. We've had a lot of growing pains dealing with false positives, false negatives. So we're still working out that process, but we feel like this is a much cleaner, we're not profiling because we're testing everybody. We did change our consent form, and we identify it specifically on our consent form now that when you show up to the hospital, you will have a blood type, a CBC, a syphilis rescreen, and a urine drug test when you arrive in the hospital, just to be upfront with the moms, a little bit cleaner than when we were doing it at the general consent. Next slide. So I'm going to turn this back to Beth, who's going to go through the poll question.
Thank you. As you've heard, there's a lot of discussion surrounding decisions to screen and or test for drug use in pregnant women and their infants. But now we'd like to hear from you. We have a couple poll questions, and we'd like to know about your policy and practices in the organizations you work with. The first question relates to a policy for screening pregnant women for drugs at your hospital. Your choices would be yes, that you screen all pregnant women, yes, that you screen, but only those with a history of drug use. No, you don't screen women for drug use. And if you are with an organization that does not provide care to pregnant women, then you can check not applicable. So please vote. Okay, we've got really a good response here. Could we see the results, Jeff? Okay, let's see, 40% of you said that yes, in your hospital you screen all pregnant women for drug use. A little bit over half of you do screen, but only if there has been a history of drug use. And 7% of you do not provide care in your organization to pregnant women. Okay, good. Can I have the second poll, please? Okay, the second poll question relates to whether you have a policy for testing babies at your hospital. And your choices would be yes, that you test all babies for drugs, or yes, that you test only babies with a maternal history of drug use, or no, you don't routinely test babies for drugs. Okay, we've got 83% of you have voted. Jeff, let's see what the results look like. Okay, the vast majority of you have a policy that only tests babies if there's been a maternal history of drug use. And 20% of those of you that work in hospitals and take care of babies don't routinely test babies for drugs. Okay, great. Now, our third question, we're interested in not screening, but testing. And we're looking at whether or not you have a policy for testing mothers at your hospital. And your choices would be that, yes, you test all pregnant women for drugs, or that you do test pregnant women, but only those who have a screen, who have a history of drug use. And you could say no, that you don't routinely test women, pregnant women for drugs, and if you don't care for pregnant women, of course you would check not applicable. Okay, we have almost 90% that have answered. Jeff, let's see the responses, please. 25% of you do test all pregnant women, as is done in Cincinnati, as Dr. Wexelblad explained, that it's just routine. All women are tested. 63% of you say that you only test women who have a history of drug use or pass a screen, and 6% do not routinely test, and the 6% we know are with us today that don't care for pregnant women. Well, don't provide care for pregnant women. I'm sure you care deeply about the pregnant woman. Let's see. Let's have the next slide, please. You know, all of this information, what you're doing and what Dr. Crowley explained about the Cleveland area and Dr. Wexelblad in Cincinnati, gives a really good perspective for the next big topic that we're going to talk about this afternoon. Dr. Crowley is going to lead the discussion on legal implications for drug testing in Ohio. Dr. Crowley?
Right. Yes, so we can go to the next slide. So this was originally presented by Dr. Jonathan Fanneroff from Rainbow. So we thank him for letting us use his slides for the webinar today. He was unable to join us. So we can go to the next slide. And disclaimer, so I am going to say I'm not a lawyer. The closest I've been was that I was Dr. Fanneroff's office mate for a few months when I first started here at Rainbow. So I'm going to try to give his slides and his reasonings give them as the best of my ability. So go to the next slide. So as the AAP has noted, issues of whether to use biological specimens to screen for drugs of abuse, whether to screen the mother, her infant, or both, and which women and infants to screen are issues complicated by legal, ethical, social, and scientific concerns. Next slide. So anytime we talk about law in this country, we need to start with the U.S. Constitution. If the law is the set of rules we live by, then the Constitution is the highest law. It creates our government and says how it works. And each state also has a constitution which sets out the highest laws for that state. Next slide. So the original Constitution adopted in 1788 set up the structure of the government but contained almost no guarantees of individual freedoms. But remember, our country was founded by men who had just fled a government that denied them religious freedom. So 3 years later, 10 amendments were added to the Constitution known as the Bill of Rights. We go to the next slide. The Bill of Rights contain the fundamental rights and freedoms of every citizen. When we talk about patient rights, there is no more important document than the Bill of Rights. This is because the Bill of Rights gives power to the fundamental bioethical principle of autonomy. Remember that autonomy is a concept that a competent adult has the moral right to choose and follow their own plan of life and action, including determining what happens to their body. The United States Supreme Court has recognized specifically that under the Bill of Rights, competent persons must be informed about their medical care and have the right to refuse medical treatment. Next slide. As Justice Benjamin Cardozo, then of the New York Court of Appeals, noted in the seminal case Schoendorf versus Society of New York Hospital, every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body. So one important constitutional issue when thinking about maternal drug testing is the right to privacy. The other is the Fourth Amendment. Next slide. The Fourth Amendment protects individuals against unreasonable search and seizure. Specifically, it states that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The U.S. Supreme Court considered whether a program that drug tested pregnant women without their consent violated the Fourth Amendment in the case of Ferguson versus the City of Charleston. Next slide. So this case involved a program at the Medical University of South Carolina, and the staff there was concerned about an increase in the number of crack babies they were seeing. So they began testing pregnant women if they met certain criteria, which included poor prenatal care, birth defects or poor fetal growth, placental abruption, a history of drug or alcohol abuse, or intrauterine fetal demise. And any of those women who were tested positive were initially referred for counseling. However, after they started doing this, they actually saw no change in the incidence of their babies that were affected by cocaine. So then they began to work with law enforcement, and they implemented a new program. Next slide. So under the new program, women were immediately arrested if they or their newborn tested positive for cocaine. One woman spent the last 3 months of her pregnancy in jail, receiving prenatal care and shackles. Another woman was arrested shortly after giving birth, still dressed in her hospital gown. The prosecutors did add an amnesty component to the program after the first year, giving women the option of treatment to avoid arrest. If they failed to complete the treatment or tested positive a second time, however, they were arrested. 30 women actually brought suit alleging that the program violated the Fourth Amendment. An opinion by Justice Stevens ruled in favor of the pregnant women, stating that the reasonable expectation of privacy enjoyed by the typical patient undergoing diagnostic tests in a hospital is that the results of those tests will not be shared with non-medical personnel without her consent. Next slide. So while the Ferguson case is significant, many pregnant women continue to be arrested and charged with a variety of crimes for using drugs during pregnancy. These include felony child endangerment, corruption of a minor, chemical endangerment, assault with a deadly weapon. Women have even been charged with delivering drugs to a minor, claiming that the drugs were transmitted from the mother to the infant after birth while the umbilical cord was still attached. Next slide. So parents are not free to do whatever they want to their children. Children are not considered property, and the government does have the power and duty to protect the safety and well-being of children. This is often known as the doctrine of parens patriae, which is Latin for parent of the nation. Next slide. So the Federal Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, or CAPTA, is the current incarnation of the Baby Doe regulation. CAPTA provides federal funding to states and defines child abuse and neglect as the at the minimum, any recent act or failure to act on the part of a parent or caretaker which results in death, serious physical or emotional harm, sexual abuse or exploitation, or an act of or failure to act which presents an imminent risk of serious harm. Next slide. CAPTA states that healthcare providers must have policies and procedures in place to notify Child Protective Services of all infants born and identified as affected by illegal substance abuse, withdrawal symptoms resulting from prenatal drug exposure, or a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and to establish a plan for safe care of these newborns. Reports of prenatal substance exposure shall not be construed to be child abuse or neglect and shall not require maternal prosecution. Next slide. However, it is important to remember that the primary responsibility for both medical practice as well as child welfare services rests with the states. Each state has its own legal and administrative policies and procedures that address the needs of children and families. And states vary widely in their approach to pregnant women who use drugs. One state allows assault charges to be filed against a pregnant woman who uses certain substances. 18 states consider substance abuse during pregnancy to be child abuse. 15 states require healthcare professionals to report suspected prenatal drug abuse. And 4 states require prenatal drug testing for suspected abuse. Next slide. So what do we do in Ohio? So actually, Ohio has been described as having somewhat an enlightened approach. And substance abuse during pregnancy is not automatically considered a criminal act, nor child abuse, nor grounds for civil commitment. And currently, a $4.2 million 3-year targeted drug treatment program for pregnant women is being supported by the Ohio Department of Health and seems to be promising. Next slide. So to summarize key points with respect to drug testing in mothers of newborns, obstetricians, pediatricians, and administration should develop policies to be followed consistently, meaning that care should not vary based on which healthcare provider or professional are on call. Hospital councils should ensure the compliance with state and federal laws. Next slide. Maternal and infant drug testing should be based on specific evidence-based criteria and medical indicators to avoid discriminatory testing. Open-ended criteria such as clinical suspicion are inadequate. Next slide. All mothers should be informed about proposed drug testing prospectively, and the rationale for testing should be documented in the medical record. The discussion should include the nature and purpose of the test and how testing will guide care. If a woman refuses testing, document the refusal and do not test over her objection. Next slide. When medically necessary for the proper and safe care of the infant, testing may be done without specific informed consent of the mother. This includes newborns who exhibit signs and symptoms of drug exposure, newborns whose mothers have been identified as probable substance users, and newborns whose mothers have signs and symptoms of drug use. And it should be noted that moms should be informed when such testing occurs. And go to the next slide. So remember that under Ohio law, all healthcare providers are mandated reporters of child abuse and neglect and are required to report when there is reasonable cause to suspect that a child has suffered or faces a threat of suffering any physical or mental wound, injury, disability, or condition of a nature that reasonably indicates abuse or neglect of the child. So I think that is my last slide on the legalities, and I'll throw it back to Beth.
Okay, thank you, Maura. The law is really complex. It's both specific and open to interpretation. We've been providing a lot of information that's real important this morning, and some of it is controversial. Our polls, the three poll questions that we ask, show different approaches to this issue of testing mothers and infants for drug use. And now we want to hear from you. What method do you use at your hospital, and why was that chosen? Have you had any challenges regarding maternal screening or testing? And if you did, how did you overcome them? We would, as I said, like to hear what you have to say. You are on mute, so if you press *6, you can come off mute and ask questions or make comments.
Beth, I have a couple questions.
Okay, good. Thanks. Can you read them to me, please?
Sure thing. The first one, both of them are from Leslie Clark. The first one is, while I understand Mercy's consent applies to all lab work, the implications for universal testing specifically are different than, say, VDRL, CBC, et cetera. In addition, when a patient arrives in labor, is that mom truly able to notice what she is signing and the implications?
Oh, great question. Doctors?
Yeah, I'll answer that one. That's a great question.
Yes.
So
good. Now it is.
We have changed, like I said, we did change our consent afterwards through the Greater Cincinnati Health Council and encouraged all hospitals to utilize it, which specifically said what 4 tests every mom is having when she arrives at the hospital. Now, a mom in labor, is she able to understand what she is signing? I'm sure, just like myself, when it says click here, that you've read this whole thing, that you just click there or sign there and you don't read it. So I don't know if they truly understand the implications, but they do know that they're given a urine specimen, that we do tell them what we are testing for. They do have the right to refuse, and we do test the patient. The whole idea behind universal testing is not punitive. This is meant to be helpful. The whole idea is to identify somebody that is having a problem, an addiction maybe, to our most, as we know from our statewide collaboration, most of our babies are not being exposed to heroin. That's only a third of our babies. Most of these moms are taking prescription opioids, and they're very addictive, and most of the time it's because physicians are over-prescribing or they've had a car accident and they've got addicted to it. So we want to get these moms help. This is not meant to be punitive. So we're only mandated to report to CPS if the infant is positive. If a mom is positive but she has a prescription for an opioid, we don't report that to CPS, but we make sure the mom is able to take care of herself, make sure she doesn't have a problem. If I fell down and broke my hip, I would get a social work consult in the hospital to make sure I have somebody that can drive me to my follow-up appointments. I have somebody there to take care of me. Same with a mom that's having a prescription opioid problem. We want to make sure that she has follow-up care to see if she has any issues that need to be addressed, if she needs to be tested for hepatitis C or hepatitis D because she's been doing behaviors that are associated with that addiction. So we view the universal testing, it's not punitive, it's the first and most important thing. We don't talk about chain of command or custody because we don't want to address that. We have not made this a punitive process. So this is really just identifying our infants we feel are likely to withdraw later on when they're discharged. And sometimes these babies are showing up into the emergency department at a week of age with failure to thrive. They're not eating well. They're losing too much weight because they're having loose stools, subtle signs of withdrawal that we want to make sure that we're identifying in the hospital. We observe all of our opioid-exposed infants for 72 hours unless they've been exposed to buprenorphine or methadone. Then we observe them in the hospital for 96 hours. We start Finnegan scores anywhere between 4 and 24 hours to make sure that we're identifying these infants prior to discharge. So that's the long answer to that.
Great, thank you. Jess, I see that there's another question or comment, I think, from Michelle.
We have a question from Leslie and then a comment from Michelle.
Okay.
The question from Leslie is, if there was a concern that women would go to another hospital to avoid the testing, doesn't that demonstrate a reluctance on the part of the woman to take the test?
Dr. Crowley or Wexelblatt, what do you think? If the woman, if you think that there is a concern that women would go to another hospital if they found out you were testing, doesn't that show that women don't want to be tested?
I suppose that's one interpretation, and you know, since we are doing, all we're doing is universal screening, so I don't know if Dr. Wexelblatt has had any experience with women who are hospital shopping.
We have actually had one mom that has did deliver outside of our region, knowing that we did universal testing, and unfortunately, that baby did show up in the hospital. There is one that we know of. With seizures from NAS. So this baby, I don't know if it was discharged within 48 hours, so I can tell you that that screening at that hospital, if they, I don't know, they delivered in Kentucky, so we're close to the border here, so it's easier to do that. So that sort of solidified our need to go ahead and continue universal testing because this was a baby who failed the screening process at their region. But I assume that that mom did deliver there because she knew that she was going to have a positive test.
And I think, you know, if you're universally screening and this is a mom who, mom who refuses testing, this is when you would be an indication to automatically, test the infant.
Mm-hmm.
And Correct. Maybe watch the infant a little more carefully for, signs and symptoms of developing withdrawal.
Great, thank you. Jess?
The comment from Michelle Cherry. At her hospital, they send meconium on everyone just in case on day 2 or 3 the baby shows signs of withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wexelblatt talked about that, the option of testing all babies.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Thank you, Michelle.
Could you have, Michelle, could you maybe come off mute and describe the, if you're sending that out, because I know that those tests sometimes come back after the baby, and how you follow up those positive results if they have come back after the infant has already been discharged, knowing that a lot of babies are discharged at 48 hours. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it would be great.
No, that's okay, because it was a big discussion of what we were, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
No, it was a big discussion because the cost of that test. At one of the hospitals I was at in Indianapolis, they did send it on every baby that came into the NICU. I don't know if they did it for term, but I know every baby that came into the NICU got tested. Here, because of the cost of the test, we do a meconium hold in the lab, just like we send the placenta for mom, and they hold it in the lab. Once the baby goes home, though, we usually get rid of it.
And so when do you send the meconium to be tested?
If they show any signs of withdrawal, then we send it.
Okay.
But I didn't know if people did cord testing instead of meconium for that instead of having to, because it is labor intensive to send meconium on 2,000 deliveries if you do 2,000 deliveries.
So we are switching to umbilical cords just because of that same exact reason at a lot of our hospitals. We're testing it out at one of our hospitals right now. So they've stopped doing meconiums and moved over to umbilical cords. The benefit is that you can send that at the time of birth, right after the baby's born. So and it's all FedEx dependent on the lab we're sending it out. The cost for umbilical cord versus meconium is the same, the benefits much easier to get the umbilical cord. And you don't have to collect it and involve three nurses and three shifts sometimes. So we've been moving towards that. We're happy with the results. It's a little and it's the same price at the current time. So we are moving towards that. And part of our Children's Hospital collaboration study, we did actually use umbilical cords to get our information. And we're looking at that data to see if we can find any significance from that. But we're looking at that. I don't know, Dr. Crowley, what you guys are doing, if any of your hospitals in that region are doing umbilical cords.
So we were only sending our umbilical cord as part of the Ohio collaborative that we had started. And at our hospital, we're still just sending urine. And then I know one of our community hospitals is sending meconium when there's a concern. And I do know that a lot in the Columbus area, that a lot of the hospitals are just routinely sending umbilical cords for testing instead of urine or meconium.
And I know in Portsmouth, what they were doing is they were holding the umbilical cords for 28 days, and any baby that was showing under 28 days in an emergency department, that was a trigger to go ahead and send that umbilical cord off for testing, since it was easier to hold the umbilical cords in the lab, obviously less smaller space than the meconium tubes.
Those are great explanations, especially when confronted with short stays post-delivery. Let's see, Jess, we have Angela Sanders from Athens.
Yes, her comment is, in Athens, we test everyone. Specifically at Holzer, they have them sign a paper stating she has been informed and that she will be drug tested. She is sure to tell them we are only testing patients so we can take care of them the very best that we can during their pregnancy. This is when I usually get their admission of what they are using. We have had very good success. I am the OB coordinator at the Athens branch of Holzer in the OBGYN office, and she's the first person to see all OB patients during their care.
Thank you, Angela. That's a very good comment, and it does bring home the idea that how controversial or difficult to talk about subjects or broached can make all the difference in the world about how well they're received. Thank you. Are there other questions or comments? If you haven't typed one in, that's okay. You can come off mute on star 6. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you, Scott and Maura, and all of you on the call for your time and interest in this important topic. For those of you that came on the call late, don't forget to put your name, your organization, and your email address in the chat box so that you can receive CME, and we can be sure that you receive invitations to the remainder of these webinars, which will be going on for at least another year. Remember that the NAS webinars are a series of three, and the third and final NAS webinar will be held in October on the 7th and the 24th, October 7th and October 24th at noon. We'll be talking about scoring infants for NAS and triggers for referral, so please watch your email box for more information. I'd like to thank you all again, and I hope that you have a very good weekend. Goodbye.
Thank you.